So welcome to this week's edition of the Retail Risk Podcast, sponsored by Axis Communications. My guest today is Terry Streeler, Director of Oakwood Training. Many of you that have been to a Retail Risk conference over the last year or two will have seen Terry on stage, musing and sharing his deep thoughts with us. Terry works with global retailers in security, loss prevention. He's a mental health and personal safety expert, an extensive experience as both a frontline practitioner and trainer. Terry's also a former frontline officer and supervisor in the police. So I think we can say he's probably got first-hand experience in crisis management for both members of the public and staff. So, Terry, thank you very much indeed for joining us this week.
Hey, thanks for having me, Paul. Great to be back.
Yeah, always a pleasure. Now, I've got a ton of questions, and goodness knows where this conversation's going to go, because you are the proverbial expert in a whole raft of subjects. But way back when, and I love to ask this question, young Terry sat at school, peering out of the window. Did you see yourself running a mental health and personal safety training company? What was your actual intended career way back when?
No, I was going to be the manager of my dad's textiles firm. Growing up in South Africa, which is where I'm originally from, and that's, my dad ran a very successful business, and that was going to be me for the future, to be honest. But then, you know, things change. And I think if this pandemic has taught any of us anything, it's that change is going to happen, right? And if there's one thing our brains don't like, it's change. And, you know, everything changed to the point where we left South Africa. We had to come back over to England, but this was in my 20s. So I was studying university at the time. I was studying psychology, of all things, just because I was fascinated by it and because of my own personal experience with mental illness. When I was about 15 years old, I developed a condition called ME. I don't know if anybody's heard of that, but chronic fatigue syndrome, or when I had it, it was rather harshly called yuppie flu. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, I do.
And of course, the mental illness that's most often associated with ME is depression. And at that time, nobody really knew what it was. And to be honest, we have a better understanding of it now, but not completely. And so I was on antidepressants from that very early age. And so I became very interested in how the brain works. You know, why is it that our brains sometimes trip us up? And so I started studying psychology in South Africa at university. But unfortunately, when we up sticks and moved to England, I didn't pick up my studies any further. And Dad says, I know, rather than going back to university, have you thought about a career in the police? And if you know anything about the police service in South Africa, it's not really an aspirational role. Let's put it that way. They're not very well paid. They're not very well supported. And unfortunately, it's a very, very dangerous job. So it had never crossed my mind that I'd join the police service. And Dad said, give it a go. And I did. And, you know, 20 years later, having gone through that and doing various bits and bobs within the police service, I specialized as a frontline officer, but I was also a conflict management instructor and trainer. So I taught officers how to fight, for want of a better phrase, with the heavy focus on what to do to avoid fighting. You know, how do we not get to that point where we have to use physical force against people? And of course, I became a sergeant within the police, which is the first rank of management. And so I was responsible for looking after a team of 20 emergency response workers who'd go out to all sorts, all the most horrific things that you can possibly imagine. And I became acutely aware that how we think and feel has a direct impact on the decisions we make and our performance, not only in the workplace, but also at home. You know, so I became super intrigued by my job as the manager was not only to make sure that they followed the correct procedures and, you know, done everything as they should do, but it was also ultimately to make sure that they were in the right headspace to be able to answer the next call, because there's always another call, right? So how do we make sure? So my interest in mental health was rekindled, I suppose, combining my own personal experience as a teenager, then with my studies at university, and then, you know, mental health first aid instructors and all that kind of thing, which I became later on. So I do have some qualifications, but I find it very interesting to combine the worlds of mental health and conflict management. Because if we go from the starting point that all behavior, whether good or bad, is a form of communication, and it's a sort of outlet for what's going on in our minds, that can be a very powerful tool when we're trying to manage or diffuse conflict, understanding what might be going on in a person's world. So a sort of very, very long answer to your question, Paul, which we knew would happen.
but it is interesting, you know, you find this. So where you are today, clearly all of those key milestones through your previous career have in effect, you know, led you to this point. It was definitely building up to this, wasn't it, in terms of of your, you know, background and your interest and what you ended up doing with the police. So fascinating. And I guess your passion ended up now becoming your full-time occupation. So with all of that, talk to me about your day-to-day at the moment. You know, what are the big areas and topics that you're working on right now? People are asking for courses and support on. What does that look like?
Well, rather, it's brilliant because people are now putting the dots together and they're realizing that rather than just dealing with mental health and well-being, and rather than just dealing with conflict management and de-escalation, all those things, or interventions, you know, loss prevention, you have to perhaps put hands on people and actually detain and restrain people, are starting to realize and understand that we shouldn't be looking at these things in silos. So a lot of the things that we're doing at the moment are blended programs, you know, where we take that siloed, traditionally siloed area of mental health and well-being, and we combine that with a conflict management course with the understanding of the psychology. So I'd say what we're spending most of our time now is psychologically informed conflict management training, which is really, really exciting. You know, and it goes back to my time in the police when I was a trainer. I did most of my time in the police, about 12 years, was teaching officers how to diffuse conflict. And very little time was spent on the communication, the mental health piece. Far more of it was spent on the actual tactics, the actual, how do I do a wrist lock or a thumb lock or a this or a that? And it's the fun stuff, don't get me wrong, and it's enjoyable, but it's kind of working the wrong way around, in my view. Less focus was placed on that, more kind of, on those softer skills, which I think a lot of people assume people just have. But we know with the changing demographics in the workforce, young people now coming into workforce, particularly in retail, you know, young people probably never had an argument or a crossword in their lives. And managers who perhaps have are just expecting these young people to go out and deal with it. So we're seeing a blended program doing a lot of those, but we're also seeing by far and away the vast majority of our work is now in the mental health space, where we're helping to support managers in supporting their teams in the workplace.
And picking off that, I've heard you talk before about, you know, we sometimes forget, you know, we can train our people, you know, I think if you've used the term, you've been on the course, so you know what to do. Yeah. But you've got some really interesting thoughts around, you know, you have to bear in mind what's going on at home. You know, people's tolerance will vary on a day to day. Just remind me and the audience of that, because I remember being, you know, blown away by this. It was just a real eye opener. It generally was, because you just don't think about it.
No, you don't. You're right. I mean, a lot of organizations, whether they be in retail or otherwise, are sort of geared up for that sort of smoking gun backwards approach. And if something does happen and it needs to fall under scrutiny, we tend to focus on the seconds or the immediate circumstances around what was going on as to why you made that decision. Was your decision reasonable in those specific set of circumstances? But what that doesn't allow for is the reality of how our brains really work, which is far more than just the split second before that person lunged towards me with a punch or they grabbed that pair of jeans from the shelf and were legging it out the door. Far more than that, that enters into my decision-making is what was going on in my life in the minutes and hours before that. You know, because then we're talking about the function of the amygdala, which is our body's fight flight center. You know, that's our risk control center, if you like, because believe it or not, that can actually become more hairline triggered. It can become more sensitive and it can actually physically grow. What we're understanding now with developments in science is that our brains retain neuroplasticity. In other words, they're continuously molding and changing shape. No two human brains are the same. You know, which I find absolutely fascinating. And depending on my life experience and circumstance, my brain might be a different configuration to yours. So, for example, that person who's standing on the shop floor, something happens in a split second, that's the amygdala, right? Yeah, but your amygdala is not the same as mine because of our circumstances. So if I go back weeks and months and I look in my life there, that shop worker's life, if they have a stressful home life, or if they have, you know, that are in an abusive relationship, for example, or they don't get on with a manager, or they're being isolated or bullied at work, chances are their amygdala will be bigger and it will be more hairline triggered. It will be more sensitive. You know, and we may then say, well, you've overreacted there. But is that their fault? You know, I think it's a fascinating question. Then we can go even back further and we can talk about weeks and months before that. You know, and how that starts to affect us. And we can talk about hormones and all sorts. And I recommend a TED talk for you. It's only 15 minutes, but it completely changed the way I think about all things conflict and mental health. And it was by a guy called Robert Sapolsky. Robert Sapolsky, Sapolsky, I think it is. He's a neuroscientist, and he gives this TED talk, which basically just talks about all the things that I've just mentioned, but he explains it far more articulately than I just did. It's absolutely fascinating that the decisions we make in the moment are very rarely only about that moment.
I think that was when you said that, and I first heard you say that, you realize it is the traffic jam that you've been in that morning. It is whether you've spilled your cup of coffee down your shirt on the way to the meeting. And I think often, when we're training people, it's a case of they've been on the course, they've passed the course on that day. There's a tick box exercise. And yes, that will give a degree of an indication in terms of how somebody's going to react. But, this whole thought process and the backstory that's going on, it brings a huge complexity to what we have to manage. But maybe explains some odd outcomes we see both from the good guys and the bad eggs as well in situations, for sure.
Well, that's a great point. So many clients and people that we've worked with before, they'll say, we've done an internal e-learning program, or we've got our guys to sit through a 5-minute video on how to manage themselves in conflict. And then we were shocked and surprised because they've done the program. But then look at this post-incident CCTV footage, or look at the body camera where they've done exactly what they shouldn't have done, and they've done the course. But you see, that doesn't take into account how our brains actually operate under real stress. You see, there's different levels of our brains. Maybe we can do a bit of audience participation for it. I don't know how you feel about this, but if you imagine that is the spinal cord going into the base of your head, and this is your head, you can imagine that this part here is the survival brain. It's the first part of our brain that develops when we're inside mum's tummy. And that takes care of all the things like your vital organs, your core body temperature, your heartbeat, all that sort of stuff. You don't consciously control those things, but they're being taken care of, right? Much later comes this bit here. If you fold your thumb over like that, that's where the amygdala is, roughly around where your thumbnail is. It's right in the center of your brain. It's right at the very core of how our brains work. And these two taken together, it's more emotional. This is the limbic brain, more emotional. Taken together, they're very often automatic and jump to conclusions. Okay. When the chips are down, they are the ones that are often in control. This bit here is the cortex, which sits over the top. And that's the bit that looks like a walnut on a scan. And we think that that's where our conscious brain is. And largely it is. That's where our rational thought is. That's the bit that's paying attention on the 5-minute video or the e-learning or the tick sheet, or the decision-making model. As I used to teach in the police service, that's the one that's operating there. But when the chips are down, the jockey, if you like, is thrown from the saddle and the horse is controlling the show. So we can reprogram the horse to do things more appropriately and in line with practice, deter and disrupt type approaches, which is very common in retail now, which seems to me about the best way to go. The problem is it's very difficult to do that virtual training. And it's very difficult to do that via e-learning or videos, because you need to actually try and put people under pressure and under stress. And we've had that with clients where we've gone in. They've in the morning, they've done the theory, the knowledge with their internal trainers. And then often they'll bring us in with our actors, our team of actors. And we go in and then we actually stress test it. And then we see very different behavior. So in one sense, we're training people and teaching them about the knowledge. But what we're not doing is changing the behaviors. And I worry about things like that. We can talk about things like body cameras as well and all that. I know that's probably where you want to go. But
yeah, I did. I want to pick up on this. So massive focus in retail at the moment around, the pressure that our staff are being put under, increased aggression. And a lot of organizations are rolling out extra measures in terms of those body cams. I call it the voice of God, which is the sort of the speaker system that can come from a central point, either over a PA or more personal. When we've got our staff in our retail environment, these things look like great tools to deploy, but what's your take on them?
Specifically around CCTV, body cameras, extra security guard things. I mean, I wore a body camera for most of my service, because we trialed them fairly early on when they were fairly new technology here in the UK. I think they are any tool that reduces risk is a good thing. I think that's super important to stress from the very outset. But I don't think we should put all of our eggs in one basket. And unfortunately, it seems like the technology basket is the one that we want to try and invest in. And these things can be of great help, of course. And there's lots of research that says that. But there's also lots of research that suggests that there's other things that we should be thinking about. So, for example, we know that wearing a body camera and having that on for a while, there is research that I've seen that suggests that can increase the levels of burnout in the wearer. Why? Because I'm constantly walking on eggshells because I've got this thing that is recording my every word and my every action. And you can imagine where that puts you in your sort of stress response. It can also make people less likely to intervene earlier because they know that their actions are going to be scrutinized and they become ultra self-conscious about everything that they do and say. So that can have a detrimental effect as well. But there's another side of this, which I think that we tend to assume that if it's on camera, then that's exactly what happened. And for me, that's missing a major factor, and that's perception. All right. So you could show a video to two people and you will get different opinions. I mean, if you've seen like in the world of sport, in rugby, I mean, I'm a big rugby fan, obviously. And I mentioned I'm South African, Paul. I don't know if I should do that.
I'm not you have a global audience. Yeah.
We've got a World Cup or two, although we're not playing very well at the moment. But, you know,
Terry, I think the signal is just breaking up. We're losing,
But look at what happened, you know, with all the controversy around the TMOs. You're in the British and Irish Lions tour, you know, and you've got Rassi Erasmus, our coach. So it's on video. It's right there. And yet you've got people who have different opinions about what happened. And ultimately, the person's opinion that matters the most is the referee, because the referee was there on the scene at the time, you know, and had a much better understanding of the full context. I worry about things like that, VAR as well. People will argue about it. Well, hang on a minute. That's not supposed to happen, isn't it? Because it's on video. It's objective. But it misses a fundamental that, you know, this is actually a subjective process, our decision making. And I worry that the cameras will become a stick with which to hit people with. In a sense of, you didn't follow procedure, you didn't do what you were supposed to do because here's the camera. Well, with all due respect, the camera wasn't making the decisions. The camera wasn't scared. The camera wasn't feeling the adrenaline in the heat of the moment. You know, how do we go back to that? I go back to training. How do we reprogram the correct response in that? So the technology can be super helpful, but at the same time, there are some considerations. I'm not saying that they're a good or a bad thing. I'm just saying that we need to have our eyes wide open when we think about introducing this technology.
And so do you think having all of this technology around is going to make staff feel safer? I know you're saying that heightened stress in terms of I'm being watched all the time, but am I going to feel more reassured? Maybe if I'm, you know, one or two members of staff working late at night in a store that's maybe in a secondary location, let's call it politely. Yeah, is it going to provide me reassurance or could it have a different effect?
I don't think you can blanket say yes or no. What's really interesting, though, is that psychologically, I mean, think about it. If I know I'm going into a workplace where there are security guards on the door, they're wearing body cameras, some of them are carrying PPE like handcuffs or spray or things like this, depending on where you are in the world or what, you know, the law allows. There's shutters everywhere. And I'm going to now walk into this place. It may lead me to the sense of being under siege. I mean, think about the terror attacks, you know, when they happened and they started hitting the world. You had more prevalence of armed police. The military were on the streets with guns. For some people, they felt reassured by that. For others, they felt desperately unsafe. So it's not as easy as just blanket calling it. What is interesting, however, is there has been some research on this by USDOR, and I wrote it down because USDOR is a union here in the UK, the Union of Shop Distributive and Allied Workers. And you know them well, Paul, I'm sure. But they actually did a survey in 2021 where they looked at body cams and they asked staff on the ground, what do you want to deal with this rising problem of violence and abuse directed towards retail staff? And what was fascinating was that they gave people the options. These were the options. They said banning offenders, body cams, posters, more staff, manager support, or time to recover post-incident. They gave them all these things. Guess what the top answer was? By a long way, manager support.
Wow.
Manager support is what people wanted. Bottom of the list was body cams. Now, I'm not saying they're good or bad. I'm just presenting you with what staff are actually wanting, what's going to work. I think sometimes decisions are made and we make huge assumptions that this is going to be a good thing, depending on your perspective and your outlook on life. But we're not all the same. So I think what's really important in this is that whatever security measure you go down, bring the staff with you. because you start to make them feel reassured. Even if you're bringing in body cams, you know, which, like I say, I wore one for years and they were brilliant. You know, I found them very useful, if I'm honest with you, and they were fantastic from an evidential perspective, as I've had several cases where they've been used in courts. But bring staff with you, because otherwise you can build in that distrust as well. Hang on a minute. The bosses think that I have to wear this camera in case I say something wrong, because then the microscope will come down on me because of my performance. So it can breed distrust if we're not careful, you know, and there has been some studies about that. So communication with staff is absolutely key. Bring them with you.
Yeah. Actually, just remind me, you're talking about communication and taking the staff. It reminds me of when I was working in retail a long time ago, and the senior management decided to do what could only be referred to as a time and motion study, but didn't communicate this to any of the stores.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, these guys and girls started appearing with clipboards, watching staff do their job while sort of writing away.
You're snooping on me, right? Yeah, you don't.
And it did not matter how balanced and small the changes that were proposed, they just were never able to take the staff with them. And actually, that reminds me, I was a member of Usdaw at the time in the particular retailer I was in. I think we all were required to join, and the unions got involved, and there was a big conflict. You're quite right. If the right stakeholders had been taken along and it was explained, because the outcome was there was going to be a redistribution of management trainees cascading down through the stores. There was going to be more bodies on the shop floor. There was going to be shorter shifts, but no reduction in hours, because that increased productivity, but also employee satisfaction. But none of that was communicated. And it was just an absolute car crash. And I think it was 3 or 4 years before it came back around and came in. And everybody went, oh, that was good. And we got a pay rise as well. So, you know.
All that worry for no reason. Yeah, exactly. Communication is where most organizations fall down. And if there's distrust amongst, you know, your rank and file or the people on the shop floor, it almost doesn't matter what you say. There's still going to be that distrust. So more than words, I think actions speak far louder. You know, so that's a critical point.
So actions, critical point. So here we are. We're in a modern workplace. Put you on the spot. Don't give away all of the trade secrets. but you know, we're on the spot. I'm going to ask you in a minute, we're going to take a word from our sponsors, but when we come back, I want your top tips, if you like, for a harmonious workplace. But first, we're just going to quickly hear from our sponsors and then we'll be back.
These days, surveillance cameras aren't just for monitoring a specific area, because with analytics, those cameras can do so much more. Like with any new development, there has been some hype, some disappointments, and lots of new options for the collection and use of data. Axis enables a smarter and safer world by creating network solutions that provide insights for improving security and new ways of doing business. For more information about Axis, please visit our website, www.axis.com.
So welcome back to this week's edition of the Retail Risk Podcast, sponsored by Axis Communications. I am, of course, still with Terry Stree, the director of Oakwood Training. Just before the break there, a very broad challenge to you. And I'm going to invite you at this point as well to weave in what it is that you guys do as well. So feel free to have permission to do a little bit of a plug in a gentle term. But, you know, what is it that you're suggesting, promoting, some top tips? How can you support retailers, brands, and organizations to achieve those goals? Start to kind of bring together our random discussions.
Well, there's so much in that, just that question, Paul. I hope you'll bring me back if I miss anything. But, you know, what can we do? Well, I think first things first, let's talk about the staff on the ground. You know, let's the worker facing the angry customer or whatever it is. What can we do in that situation? Some real simple top tips is number one, keep your distance. You know, distance is your best friend in any form of conflict, because it doesn't matter how skilled or, you know, how much of a ninja the person in front of you is. They can't hurt you if they can't reach you. So keep your distance. I think one of the key things is to remember, or try and remember and remind yourself, that it's very rarely personal, you know, because when we start to take things personally, that amygdala, that fight flight part of your brain reacts even stronger, because now it believes it's under direct attack. All right. So remember, or try and remember, that it's not personal. That person may just be using that, you know, outburst of aggression or anger as a tool, as an instrument, if you like, to get their way, to get what they want, or cause you to back down or whatever. You know, so I've written a few things down here. We are big advocates of an approach to conflict, which is called calm, relate and manage, based on some work that was done at Loughborough University here in the UK. Calm, relate and manage as a general approach to managing conflict. All too often, people try and jump in to manage a situation. And that can often just antagonize, because you've got to remember, if somebody is angry or aggressive, it's their emotional part of the brain that's in control, right? It's this bit. It's not the logical part of the brain. So don't go trying to suggest clever, you know, solutions or anything like that. Not yet. You've got to establish rapport and trust first before we can get to that point. You know, and I wish people in conflict would just slow down and stop reacting to what each person does, or the raise of an eyebrow or the tone of a voice, because we're very good at getting offended and jumping to conclusions very quickly. You know, so those are big ones. I think when we're talking to people, one of the biggest mistakes I see people do, with regardless of sector, is they get all official with their language and they use quite strategic nonsense words that nobody really uses. And all that really does is alienate that person even more. It creates more of a disconnect. So be human in the way that you talk and try and talk, you know, calm people down. Use real words. Now, you must have seen it, like, you know, the police spokesperson. Oh, the vehicle was traveling in a northwesterly direction along the A432. Nobody actually speaks like this. You know, I've met the people who are doing those interviews and they don't talk like that when they're not on camera. But why do we do it? It just raises tension and causes problems. And then there's some really simple communication approaches. But I think it's really important that we remember that everybody wants to be respected. At its core, everybody wants to be respected. How often do you see conflict kicking off or triggered because, you know, people feel disrespected? You know, so what can we do to, you know, make people feel respected? And there's a few more points that I've written down, but I don't want to go into a full, like, you know, a full teach on that. The second point is about managers and what we can do to create that environment where it's more proactive, where we're looking into, you know, how people are actually doing. And there's a couple of really simple things here. Take care of the threats, whether they be perceived or otherwise. You see, because if I perceive there's a threat, even if there isn't really one in front of me, my fight flight center is still triggered, right? I'm still going to be flooding my system with all those endorphins, the noradrenaline, all those things designed to get me away from danger. All right. So whether it's real or not, deal with the threats. And the only way you can really do that is by talking to your people and finding out what's bothering them, which is why I quite like that Usdaw survey. Now, what do you want? And I found that manager support was key. So what can managers do to create that happy environment in the workplace where people feel calm, they feel supported? You know, in the UK, year on year, 50-odd% of all working days lost is because of stress, anxiety, and depression. And when we dig deeper, we find that the main causes of that stress, anxiety, and depression year on year is too much work, it's violence or aggression in the workplace, and it's a perceived lack of manager support. It's not rocket science, you know? It really isn't rocket science. So how can we build that out so that we've got more support in the workplace? Listening to people, finding out what they're really worried about. As a manager, you don't need a qualification to show someone that you care. When I was a manager, I was really worried about saying the wrong thing. I was worried about making it worse by poking my nose in when I thought something might be wrong with someone, or someone might be struggling, for example. And it's only since I left management that I've realized that actually, you know what? I don't need to be a psychologist to ask someone, hey, are you all right? I've noticed this and I'm wondering that. And so a conversation might look something like this. I've noticed that you've not seemed yourself over the past couple of days. You've seemed a little bit snappier than you usually are. And I'm wondering if everything's all right. You see, but you can't have a conversation like that if you haven't established trust.
No.
So one of the things that I'd recommend for managers and organizations is to work on something called the emotional bank account. This is a really, really old concept that was put forward by Stephen Covey in his book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And it's super simple. You can make it really complicated, but in its purest form, it's really simple. It means every interaction that I have with someone is an opportunity for me to make a deposit in the trust or rapport bank account with that person. And so that when I have to have a difficult conversation, or a conversation that I might find challenging, like, how are you? I've noticed you're not all right. Or, goodness me, you could have dealt with that better. You know, or why is your performance dipped? I've got enough of a deposit built up in the bank account so that I won't go overdrawn and completely ruin my relationship with that person. It makes having those challenging conversations easier. How do you do that? You take care of the small things. You take care of the things that matter most to that person. You give them time. You follow through on your promises. You know, if you've got a meeting or an appointment with them, never cancel that appointment because you're telling them that they're not important. You know, so make them a priority. And you'll find that you start to create that more proactive environment where well-being is taken care of.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, top tips there. And for anybody that hasn't read the book, if you don't have time to read the book, get it on Audible, listen to it. Great, great book. So this, you know, who are you working with to sort of communicate this to them? You know, what's your what's the commercial activity that you're doing? And I know, you know, are these 2-hour courses? Are you taking, you know, 2 days with smaller groups? Is there a kind of favorite at the minute? How's it all sort of connecting together?
Yeah, there's no set. You know, everything that we do is bespoke. Apart from things like mental health first aid, which are a qualification that we deliver, which we didn't come up with. That's an internationally recognized qualification. We deliver those, and they have set timescales and course content. So we can't alter that at all. But the bespoke elements, you know, they range from anything from an hour to, you know, to 4 days. You know, we're doing bigger programs in different sectors. So, for example, we're working in the custody sector. We were training detention officers who work in custody suites. And we're teaching them a wide range of skills. But the heavy focus is on de-escalation and communication. But they also need things like restraint. They need handcuffing. They need various bits and bobs as well, which we add into the program. In terms of who we're delivering, too, we're working with the likes of, you know, retailers like Sainsbury's, like Next, TK Maxx or TJX, I think they're called globally, Superdrug, AS Watson. You know, we're working a lot with those organizations in both mental health and conflict management. So they're realizing that these things are joined up, which is fantastic. Now, we've been running blended programs as well, like I said, with the likes of Sainsbury's, where we've been talking about things like, how do you manage conflict where the person who is upset clearly has a mental health issue or is clearly struggling with hearing voices or is, you know, in an altered, you know, altered state of reality, delusions and hallucinations, things like that, which is a really, really interesting subject. You know, it's really, really fascinating. So there's do's and don'ts when it comes to that as well. But yeah, I hope that's given you sort of a kind of, so our programs are either live or virtual, or we even do e-learning, you know, just because some people just want to give as much information as they can. And the e-learning is an opportunity to dive a bit deeper, bearing in mind the restrictions and limitations that I mentioned and highlighted earlier.
Yeah, sure. And did I hear a rumor correctly that our own Retail Risk Leicester event in December that you're going to be making an appearance in one form or another?
I certainly am. Yes, I'm very much looking forward to that. Yeah, depending on whether it's virtual, I think it's face to face. Is it?
Oh yeah, absolutely face to face. Yes, yeah, we're completely face to face.
Very much looking forward to that. Well, I'll be talking about this very subject about decision making and stress. You know, and diving a little bit deeper in a more sort of coherent, structured way, perhaps with the use of some visual prompts and slides and things like that to keep me on track. But just to tease out, you know, some of these issues that we've spoken about already.
So, no, amazing. Always an absolute pleasure. A million and one cul-de-sacs and roads we could have gone down. So thank you for keeping it on a roughly straight and narrow. Hopefully our audience found that as interesting as I did. Terry, it's always an absolute pleasure. And for those in the UK, yes, my recollection was correct. I think we're the 2nd of December at the King Power Stadium in Leicester. I will look forward to seeing you there. But for now, Terry, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much. Take care, everybody.